We are back. Hi, everybody. This is the Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Hey, my name's Jakob, and this is a podcast where we are talking about each and every episode of the hit HBO show, The Wire, and we're back to discuss season 4, episode 4, Refugees. Refugees.
Nice little delivery there. Thanks for that. You know, real quick before we move on to like the content of the episode, I have like a little theory, like, you know, the title Refugee could like refer to a bunch of different things. Could it possibly be in reference to Lance Reddick feeling like a refugee away from the set because this is the only episode that doesn't feature Cedric Daniels?
I never noticed that.
That's digging too much.
That could be. We'll get in touch with AO Despair on Twitter.
anchor.fm / the gods will not save you / support in case you want to donate.
Yeah, so let's get started. We'll just talk about this intro. Crazy
this
intro.
Poker game. Yeah.
Yeah. Marlo Lute. So is he, he's losing.
Yeah, he's
at that point.
He's getting sharked in this game by older gentlemen. They seem like it's again kind of like a bait and switch thing that we saw with Omar, I think, in the last episode, where like it seems like they're in like, you know, a nice house with all the proper amenities. But then once after Marlo leaves, he emerges and it seems like it's kind of like an abandoned row house? Like
when
Marlo leaves the poker game, like,
oh, okay. I don't think it was, but it was like something maybe like the exit reminded me of when Omar went to visit that one alcoholic dude about Latasha's case and was like, don't say anything. Or like, you remember me from the neighborhood? I don't know. It just seemed pretty low key. Like that's not like a place you'd probably want to advertise for good reason, right? That we're going to talk about a little later.
Yeah.
So stick with us. We got all more hot poker takes.
Please stay with us.
Yeah. Just,
no, but is Marlo losing this game and like getting kind of like mopped the, you know, the older guys like mopping the floor with him? Does this kind of like fit into the broader theme of education and like people imparting wisdom on youngers and stuff like that?
People are getting schooled this episode, right?
Exactly.
Everything relates back to the schoolhouse.
I mean, if you think about it, like Marlo is also kind of getting schooled by the security guard at the store he's stealing lollipops from.
Like, yeah. Does he say, he's like, I'm not trying to, you know, school you, or I'm not trying to step to you.
Yeah, I'm not stepping to you.
Yeah, he's a, God damn it, I looked him up.
The guy who plays the security guard?
Yeah, he's like a local guy. I saw him. He played a Fat Waller in a musical from either Coppin State. I think it was Coppin State.
Philip Burgess.
Amazing.
It would have been nice if he had a musical number in this scene right here.
They could have brought him back for the Wire musical from like the row house where he's entombed to sing about lollipops.
That's right.
All
right.
But on a serious note, this is a crazy scene.
It's definitely like the first time that Marlo or like anybody in the show kills somebody like indiscriminately for no reason. Like he kills the security guard just because he's feeling spiteful that like somebody was like trying to quote unquote condescend to him or teach him a lesson about like being a family man and having responsibilities. But this is like, I feel like maybe like the first really big showcase episode for Marlo. Like we've seen like flashes of how ruthless he is in the past, but this is like where he kind of like really announces claiming that he's like claiming the scene right now, pretty much showing that he's going to be the new head honcho, the new guy in town to be fucked with.
He's going to be the new guy to be fucked with.
that can't be fucked with.
Okay, I was about to say, like, all right, I'm the alpha in town now. Fuck with me.
As we can see later, he definitely isn't all about that.
He ain't man for the street. RIP to Mr. Security Guard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and also, you know, he's getting picked up from the store up on Monroe.
Yeah.
And Chris is going to pull up, you know, at the end of their interaction.
Yeah.
And you can already tell the security guard's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, he already knows exactly what's going on. He says that.
Yeah.
But Chris is just like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Trouble. But, you know.
Security guard more or less implies that he knows his, like, status as a kingpin or whatever.
But, I don't know. I mean, if Chris would have went to the grocery on Monroe, Marla wouldn't have been there, because this is for sure on Patterson and Federal on the east side.
Yeah.
But I know, like, save it for the map. Like, it's all in the game, you know.
Also, maybe meet him on Monroe is like code that he's using. Okay. So it's not like if he knows he's being on the wire, if he knows he's on the wire.
Yeah, he's like, we're switching it up, man. I'm really at the Saveland grocery over on Patterson, and that's like they're calling audibles, like,
yeah, you know. That's like their version of like switching the street signs.
they're hoppering the wire, which is about to get shattered anyways. But you can never be too cautious.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll keep my geo bones to pick to like to a minimum. I'm trying to like evolve Willie and just get more analytical. Just
maybe people want to hear this.
People don't. I mean, if you know Baltimore, like, people will be like, that's the Sabland, like, that, you know, it's not Monroe, but it's all, you know, it's all good.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this interaction and maybe some of the historical implications, because it gets pretty crazy.
I would love to, like, rabbit hole a little bit.
Oh, yeah. So I know we talked a little about Marlowe's inspirations, and, you know, everything's a composite. There's not like as Simon and Burns will talk to, you know, politics, like, oh, Carcetti's O'Malley and this is this person. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work like that, because at the end of the day, we're all just stuck in one big simulation.
Right.
And everything is everything. We're all responsible and culpable for the problems that exist in society, education, and beyond. Ooh. More or less, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're all on the journey here in the universe, but Linwood Rudy Williams is definitely like a big time inspiration for the composite of, you know, street characters. And I think Marlowe definitely exhibits some of his tendencies, even if in this instance, it's like a very specific example, right?
Yeah. With David Simon referencing like a time when Linwood Rudy Williams supposedly killed a security guard after like getting in an altercation with his wife or something.
Yeah. So, I guess it was on North Avenue. So that's like, you know, different, whatever specifics, but, I guess his wife Lisa was getting hassled by a security guard about shoplifting or something of that nature. So he ended up dying, but Rudy claims that it's all, you know, like hearsay, and he's got a lot of stories and currently serving a very long, like, he got life with no parole in like 92 or 91. So he's just been in jail this whole time, just doing a lot of stuff.
The judge is not having any of it. Like, I'm like reading that article, you sent me, and then like reading the interview afterwards, with like how like eloquent his defense was, like, and how like you know, disturbingly charming he can seem at times, and like charismatic. It's so like funny that the judge recognized like his like dashed potential in life, because he like saw how smart he was, but in the end of the day he saw that he was kind of just like a cold-blooded sociopath and did not succumb to like any theatrics that he was displaying during the trial.
Yeah, because Simon, his article is pretty David Simon. I mean, he's like, I know we talk a lot about, and I want to hear your perspective on this because it's like Greek tragedy. Right. But then he compares Rudy Williams to Richard III, which is like a Shakespearean like spin on things. So
yeah.
So and like here's one thing Willie was talking about in regards to Rudy's defense. He's like, "We shall overcome without a doubt," Williams told the judge, wrapping his crimes in the language of civil rights. "And in 1993, I'll be free." The words left Judge Kaufman cold. "Life, no parole," he told Williams. God damn.
Yeah.
But then later, he says, like, you know, like, go fuck yourself to the judge and all that stuff. So,
right.
I mean, it's not like there wasn't a lot of stuff he was involved in, like drugs, you know, drug dealing,
large quantities, right?
That span like global, you know, it was a global operation, so it wasn't just like getting stuff from New York City, it's like Brazil, Nigeria,
and the security guard, like part of like the security guard's big mistake, if you know, he did kill the security guard, which he denies, part of the mistake was probably like hassling the wife too, right? Because didn't Rudy Williams say like, "Me and my wife like executed all these people together"?
They
were like fucking Bonnie and Clyde.
A lot of people disappeared or like crazy instances of murder and not just like people getting shot, but like guys like IV got tainted with HIV.
Wow.
And they said that they thought it might have something to do with him.
Pretty psychotic.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. But I don't know.
A lot of that stuff that I was like reading about him, it's almost like he's kind of like the Funhouse mirror version of Marlowe, because it just like adds to our whole like simulation debacle.
Yeah.
Because like Marlowe is very like soft spoken and still, and like, you know, prefers to not talk when it's not needed.
Yeah.
But this guy is like so animated in the interview I read with him, where he's talking about like it's mentioned that he wrote a book while in jail and it's got published. And it's almost like he was trying to like David Simon his own experiences, because he drops like real names and places. I don't know if you went on to Amazon and read the synopsis.
I didn't, but it's called Power Moves, right?
Power Moves, right. But if you just like indulge me, this is like a real
we're just gonna talk about Rudy Williams this episode because we could.
But like the synopsis, I have like a sneaking suspicion that he might have written it himself, or I don't know what's going on here, but I'm just gonna read it as is. "Life is chess, and chess if life. Though deeply flawed, Michael Jones is larger than life, leaving behind a long trail of bullet-ridden bodies from Baltimore's urban streets to Wall Street. At the tender age of 15 years of age, Michael becomes ensnared in the vicious and deadly drug trade in Northwest Baltimore and rapidly rises to become an ultra-smooth international grandmaster in the game of life, big business, and politics. Through his $300 million investment company, PICTO, which publicly means Perfect Investment Company and Trade Organization, privately known only to Michael's inner circle, PICTO is actually a highly secretive codename for the far-flung, nefarious, continuing criminal enterprise, CCE, designated the Michael Jones crime family by the U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, and the Baltimore City Police. Very well written by one who knows the ruthless, brutal, and wicked ways of the world and running over with priceless knowledge, wisdom, and gems. Power Moves is an action-packed drama and suspense thriller like no other ever. read it and count the bodies as they quickly pile up page after page. This is like Marlo on bath salts or something.
That's all.
Like, I have no, like, that summary, like, went through, like, so many different, like, unexpected turns of, like, incomprehensibility.
He's like, oh, man, we got to start dealing in picto currencies. But, like, he said he liked David Simon, and this book came out in 2012, right? So, like, let me ask your opinion about some simulation type stuff. So his main character is named Michael, and we're talking about season four. Right. And then he had a nephew whose first name was Naaman, who got sentenced to like 50 years. He got sentenced to a crazy amount of time too when he was kind of young. So I'm like, you know, Simon's maybe borrowing a name from him, and then he's borrowing a name from David Simon.
It's all a conspiracy. They have like an open line of, they have like a direct line of communication. Like David Simon is giving him notes on his story. No.
Yeah. It's good.
But also like the cover graphic of the book, it's like on Amazon, it's like a chess, it's like a chessboard, but with like, it's like you see like guys with guns like on the chessboard, but their shadows are like a, you know, like a king or a knight or a rook or something. So
a king, like King Richard III, when David Simon, like they had an artist or what was it? That picture? We got to post that picture where it's like him wearing like one of those old school British wig type things.
It's like a really weird Photoshop.
Like a 19, like, well, yeah, that article came out more recently from City Paper, like 2015.
Right.
But the one I sent you is like straight up David Simon, just like get, like just ripping through articles, getting ready to write, or he had written Homicide, right?
Yeah. 92.
Yeah, that was 92.
The article, right?
Yeah.
And Homicide was like,
I thought it was like late 80s.
Yeah.
But what do you think? Like, so Marlo at the very end of his character arc can't deal with the politics and he dips out. But in that article with the interview with Rudy, he's talking about all that crazy stuff he was doing with politics. Like, he's like, yeah, I campaigned a little for Kurt Schmoke. Like,
is that, like, that has to not be real, right? Like, that.
I wouldn't put it back because, like, crazy people like Kenny Burr, Jackson, all them, they're like, yeah, he donated money to Lawrence Bell and Kurt Schmoke. So I don't know about having Rudy campaign for you. I don't know what it was, like his state's attorney run or his mayoral candidacy, because it could have been either. The timelines match. Imagine having a campaign. Like, that's his norm. Nah, that's Kurt Schmoke. I mean, I don't know too much, and he seemed like a good guy, so I don't want to.
Kurt Schmoke.
Yeah, I don't. But I mean, he's like, yeah, I'd have lunch with like Clarence Du Burns. He's like, you know.
Yeah, Clarence Du Burns. I know him.
Yeah. What are you talking about, man? Like, I go to the big parties and I'd be like, what's up, little Willie? What's up, everyone? And meanwhile, Marlo's like, get me back to the street. I want to like, try to like, you know, like turn around someone's weapon on themselves and like try to shoot them if they come at me.
Yeah, he'd rather rule in hell than serve in heaven.
Oh,
that's I think that's from like Truth Be Told. Like, I think it's from the Wire book. Like, somebody was like, it's a Marlowe's Miltonian destiny. It's paradise. That's his version of Paradise Lost.
God damn, dude.
Whatever.
You gotta get back to TBT. TBT. That's thanks for sharing, though. Yeah, I mean, what a crazy guy. And I mean, yeah, they rumored like, oh, you know, he killed this person. He killed this person. He's like, you know, they say I killed like 200 people, but that's all a lie. And I like David Simon, but Ed Burns and the feds, they cheat a little bit, you know. He's calling them out. I like David Simon, but not Ed Burns so much. Yeah. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
That's really funny.
Because he was pissed that they made him out to be like a big time crack dealer, because obviously it was like during the crack era when he got busted. But he had said, and oh, you know, someone told me that you know, the whole crack thing is just morally wrong. Like, it wasn't in Baltimore at that time, but the guy was from New York and he was saying, this is, that's going to happen to these people. So I just stayed out of it. I just stuck to heroin and apparently, campaigning and campaigning with Linwood Rudy Williams. nice. So if you ever hear this, sir, Mr. Williams, we're just, you know, trying to learn more about the Wire universe. Nothing personal, of course.
Yeah. Come on the podcast if you want.
We'll reach out, man. Yeah. You seem creative and also, in, like, yeah, a little.
I like your music taste, too. Like, you seem like.
When you jogged, did you say, you know, do you listen to anything similar?
No. Like, what did he say? Like, Blondie?
I don't remember.
Like, rap, like, old school R&B and stuff? But back to
back to the
Wire universe proper, we definitely see like Marlo ascending to become like a king almost a lot in this episode. He is killing peons indiscriminately. He's realizing that he needs to like work on his poker game more and comes back and gets ruthless with it. He's letting Proposition Joe that he's not all about joining the co-op, you know, all kinds of stuff that is really, you know, signaling his rise. But getting back to central theme of education, we have Proposition Joe naively like reaching out to Marlo at his pigeon coop to try and let him know like the benefits of, you know, being part of an organization. Marlo refuses. So then Proposition Joe tries to teach Marlo a lesson maybe by sicking Omar on his game. Is that like the motivation behind it? Is this like a weird like drug kingpin's style of education? Like some pretty labyrinthine plotting going on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to read it as. Because honestly, I was a little confused because he does shake his hand, but then nothing like seems to actually get done. So I don't think Prop Joe would risk himself, like put himself at that much risk if it were to do with something like petty as opposed to Marlo constantly refusing to join.
Right.
You know, and like, he didn't like my bird analogies, which I don't, he's like, you know, like birds don't want to worry, but also like, what do you think the birds mean? Like bird, like, what is it? Birds of a feather flock together.
Mm-hmm.
And also like birds, you know, that's like a term for like a key of coke, right?
Oh,
so he's talking about the birds and like the co-op.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know.
Brick squad. Blocka. Bow. Anyways, yeah, so I mean, you kind of went through a lot of different things, but if you just want to keep it rolling, we'll just like keep it thematic instead of the little divots of stories. I don't know, because I mean, if we're gonna move on, I just want to mention, you know, he's also like putting pressure on Bodhi, finally giving him the ultimatum,
right?
And I just found it interesting and something I didn't realize in prior watches, who drops off the package.
Yeah, Bodhi's future killer, O-Dog.
Yeah, so, you know, a major obstacle in his ascendance to top dog.
Yeah.
As we talked about a long time ago.
Pretty crazy things you pick up on in rewatches here in this show, the amount of foreshadowing for every little thing.
You know, because I watched this show when I was a lot younger, and obviously my brain was still forming.
Right.
Cuddy is hungover because he got drunk and smoked a blunt and did cocaine at the orgy.
Is that what I sound like for real? No,
it's way more succinct. Cuddy is hungover because he did cocaine and shotgunned a blunt and had an orgy.
Nice.
Like, so why is Jakob not, you know, been at your podcast lately? He is hungover because...
that's good funny. Stuff.
Well, whatever, man. But yeah, he's just, that's, I getting back to the whole prop Joe Marlomar thing. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, prop Joe has to be his motivation because he's a little more calculated than just sending Omar after people,
right?
Knowing the consequences.
Yeah.
But what, I mean, do you have any other thoughts on it? Or is it just like, that's kind of it, right?
I think so, yeah. Like, it definitely, like, when you're first watching it, I feel like you're like, wait, what? Like, why the fuck is, like, what's going on? And it is, like, puzzling the way they interact. Like, when Marlo, like, says, like, I'm not interested, but he still, like, offers his hand out. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to get like too, but like they talk in the commentary about like how originally the scene, like they cut the scene for time because there's a lot more dialogue where they're talking about it. And they're at the end of the day, they're just like, Marlo doesn't talk much. Like he doesn't need to, like, he doesn't say more that needs to be said. Like, we're just going to like end it. Like in his mind, he knows what he's saying. Like we might have a little trouble catching up, but that's just the way it goes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe also the handshake was like, oh, okay, maybe I'll help you about the East Side thing, or was that like a package deal, because Chris and Snoop eventually do help out with the New York intrusion on their East Side territory. But yeah, I mean, that's different though, because Marlo's like taking over the Cope at that point.
Exactly.
I don't know, man.
Man,
it's a lot. It's just, it's like a, not even midway, like through the season. It's just like, man, how does anyone follow? I don't know. Maybe I'm too harsh on people who are not like, The Wire is my favorite show. I'm like, oh, you don't have like unlimited hours to just constantly rewatch the show.
Yeah.
You gotta get with us.
Yeah,
Willie two times.
The only measurement that matters on Marlo is the 18 inches between his head and his heart. Because
tell me more. I have no idea how you go.
No, I can't remember like where, like I read that in one of the articles that I was like rabbit holing yesterday, when they're like talking about Marlo's significance in the Wire universe, and like, oh, the old prison adage, like, oh, what only matters is between head and his heart. I don't know exactly what that means, but he is like a really like still person, you know, like a lot of actors try to compensate by like moving their bodies around too much. And it's like crazy how deadpan Jamie Hector is in this performance. He doesn't really have to do anything. He's fucking terrifying. And his head looks like it's on a swivel almost. And like his limbs are just like, I don't know, they're like controlled by like a remote or something that they only need to do like the bare minimum.
Yeah.
So like when he reaches out for the handshake of Proposition Joe, it's almost like I'm like fearful. I'm like, what is, like he's moving his, one of his digits. Like, does that mean?
He's like the Kawhi Leonard of the universe, but and like his economics, you know, of his body movement. Mm. He's like an NBA player who people say is like programmed.
Yeah. What else do we want to say about this? He doesn't really have any patience for Old Face Andre.
Yeah.
So he jacks his ring, which is like gonna make its way through half of West Baltimore.
Tell me about that.
So like, so you know, Old Face Andre is complaining to Marlo. You know, Omar robbed his store in last week's episode, and like, he's saying like Omar's like a terrorist. He needs to get bailed out like an airline.
I mean, I wrote that note, but I don't know if that was true. But he was saying like, you know.
But anyway, Marlo like says like basically he's just like, you know, giving Old Face Andre tough love, and then he takes his very expensive ring from him. And like the path that this ring goes through like throughout the season, Omar then takes it off of Marlo, and then I think Donut gets it at one point, and that's when the cop breaks his finger and takes it, right? And then Michael takes it from the cop. Like, what do we make of, well, I mean, I guess, you know, to be continued. We'll talk about that moment. We'll get to that. We'll cross that bridge when we get to that or whatever. Like, But I like to hear your thoughts on what you think that like symbolizes, or like what that means thematically, how that relates to education and the train tracks and
everything.
The IBS and political. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know, man. We're all just stuck in some like loop. It's all one ring of chaos.
Yeah. The cyclical nature of people's affinities for expensive jewelry.
Yeah, sure. At the Shane Cole and the diamond business. Oh, you've got a friend. Okay.
But anyway, pretty crazy. Like, Marlo comes back for round two of the poker game.
Yeah.
Determined to, get this 150K jackpot, and is like refining his skills, which is in sharp contrast to the crooked, rigged game, you know, shameless fundraising racket that Mayor Clarence Royce is running, where he's just like automatically, getting everybody to donate money to him and in the like sham of a Texas Hold'em jackpot. Yeah.
I mean, if Krawcheck is disturbed, then, you know, things are off, man. Like, yeah. Even he's, yeah. I wonder what Clay Davis would have thought about it.
I don't even want to do it. It's so played out by now.
No, come on, man. Yeah. Royce is, you know, got his walking around money, which I think is old. I mean, that's like, obviously, you know, a lot about politics and stuff. Isn't that like basically just kind of like, but regular term for, you know, like, I think it goes back to machine politics and like patronage, where, you know, the politicians would give out like walking around money to people. Mm-hmm. And in Baltimore, it could mean, you know, like the white ward bosses would give them to, you know, the black people they had working for them, who would then give it to like the patronage, like the, you know, regular voters to either go vote or just like stay away from voting. Sometimes it was like, it would go either way, you know? So wow. I just found it like interesting. They kept saying, yeah, walking around money.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, similar to what Marlo's asking for from Chris. So.
Right.
But in a different context.
Yeah. But how, yeah, it's kind of crazy that, well, also I was thinking like walking around money could be like, oh, this is going to go into my lawsuit settlement fund for when that girl who gave me a blowjob files the sexual harassment. But it's, yeah, crazy like amount of parallels with, you know, Clarence Royce and Marlo, where it's like one king figure is like slowly on his way out, but Marlo's like on his way up in the, in this, you know, criminal stratosphere, ladder or whatever.
Ladder sphere.
But what do we make of his like waffling on the like publicity issues, like the distribution of the flyers and like his commentary, like on the design or like the colors?
Oh, yeah, because Coleman needs him to embrace some new strategies due to Gray pulling really well. So he's like, you know, okay, so these are the African colors and you want me to wear dashiki like Marion Barry, who, you know, say what you want, he got in trouble smoking crack, but, or, you know, possessing crack,
yeah,
and malign, but, you know, true Wire fans, if you're reading George Pelicano's novels, you'll know that certain characters, you know, from DC are like, he still did a lot for us in the black community.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't really know like too much. I've had it on my docket to look more into Marion Barry's style,
right,
his wardrobe, but, you know, we can just assume that was like more, you know, like his Afrocentric attire was a part of his identity and politics and life in general.
So, yeah. Well, and then while Royce and Coleman are debating, like, maybe, like, the shallow aspects of, like, playing up kind of, like, cultural stereotypes or whatever, Tommy is trying to sidestep the whole, like, issue by, like, trying to meet with the interdenominational ministerial alliance.
Oh yeah.
Like kind of trying to, you know, meet them where they are and like talk to them with an honest perspective on things, and doesn't really expect an endorsement, but he's trying to, you know, level with them a bit, which is more that can be like, it's ostensibly like a more honest approach, and it's more strategically viable than whatever, you know, Royce's advisors are doing.
Yeah.
Fuck Arcetti, though. He becomes crooked just like the rest of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is this like an honest approach, or is he just kind of, he's been doing that with the cameras from last episode. He's like, oh, I got to go Marlo with it. Like, less is more. Or you know, Ed Burns is like been in, you know, Aidan Gillen's ear about Carcetti. Like, remember, like, this is why I told Michael. You probably never know who he is. He's a kid from the street. He's also in Rudy Williams' novels. Less is more.
But also, I don't know, but like, Ed Burns is probably just like, man, fuck this. I don't want to get involved with the politics shit.
Let's go to Tillman or wherever we're at.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was more on the lookout, like, who are these guys? You know, is Frank Reed a part of this? But that's not real Frank Reed.
I couldn't find him on the IMDb.
Yeah, that's not. I mean, I don't know. Just the guy who was at the head of the table, he just kind of, like, he's the, you know, head of the table there. But one day we'll get to the bottom of these interdenominational ministers. And I don't know what you call the ladies there. I mean, they're ministers too. We're like car guys, gun guys, religion guys. Yeah. We know.
Our specialty.
Yeah. So we'll get to the bottom of their identities. Bring that content you're asking for.
Yeah.
Oh. All right, man. So where are we at? We're at... you want to talk, or unless you got something else to say, but Yunetta.
Yeah, Yunetta shows I was going to pivot to that.
Anyways, there's an 11th district council meeting, so.
It's like kind of like a debate almost, yeah. Like it's like a weird format. It's sparsely attended for sure.
Yeah, but it's like a early morning like college class or something. Yeah. People are like, yeah, can we just like stop asking questions? We'll get out of here quicker.
And this is like the first time we've heard Yunetta's character speak. It's like an ongoing joke that, you know, she's always missing from everything. And it's kind of like she's giving some like, I mean, people are applauding her answers, but it's kind of just like baseline, like not really addressing larger systemic issues. This guy is upset about like halfway houses like being built in his neighborhood, and she's like, not if I have anything to say about it. Marla Daniels is like, well, drug addiction is like a real issue we have to like look at in this city. And it becomes like kind of like a but Yunetta does like bring up the important point, like, oh, they're only putting the halfway houses in black poor neighborhoods. So some interesting issues brought up, but like Odell Watkins seems underwhelmed by Yunetta's performance, and to his shock he looks at the flyer and still sees that she's being co-endorsed along with Royce, even though Royce offered up her seat as kind of like a consolation to him. So the cracks are, you know, forming all around Royce, like he's making one too many miscalculations.
Man, you know exactly what I was like focused on in that exchange. I was like, 800, is he saying North Carlton or North Carrollton? Because they kind of run adjacent, but I don't know. There is no 800 North Carlton. And 800 North Carrollton, that's, I don't know what the, you know, district boundaries were back in, you know, mid-2000s or whenever, you know, the Wire universe gets all wild. You know, sometimes references are from the 80s and this and that, but based on what I've seen, the 11th district's boundary most recently, as far back as I can find, is Fremont, which is just, Fremont is just to the east of Carrollton, and that's the boundary. So this would be in the 6th district. So what are they like?
Do you think
that is like gonna get stuff done in a different district, kind of like how Bunny hides his hamster dams in other precincts.
Or maybe this is just part of David Simon's, you know, overall agenda, is that he's trying to get people caught up in the simulation. So he's like redistricting on the show, hoping that it'll like change the districts up in real life.
It's like his little, his little gerrymandering. Yeah. He's gerrymandering our brains, like chemistry and stuff, and like, everything is.
He's a good guy. I don't think you do that. I don't think
you're not going to Carcetti him. No, I don't. I love how it's like, is it? No, I don't think. I don't think you gerrymander my brain. My mental health is deteriorating. Thanks to you. No, I'm just kidding.
What the fuck?
Let's call Rudy.
Jesus.
At least I'm not yawning this episode. I'm just hallucinating.
So I'm thinking from this point, we could go to like Cuddy and how that ties into the school with Bubbles. And then for the end, circle back to the police.
Yeah. So like, let's talk about Cuddy. We've been calling him Cuddy for a while, but it's Dennis now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is.
All right. Dennis, our apologies, Mr. Wise.
Jack Coleman.
Yeah, you are getting some notice. There's buzz in the community surrounding his gym.
Yeah.
And he, you know, gets visited by the deacon.
Right.
Because a good church man is always
up in people's shit.
Yeah, so he's got him, you know, a line on a union wage job. So unions aren't completely...
right.
You know, I mean, we're talking about education a lot, so yeah. Teachers unions, good stuff. But yeah, he's going to go to Tillman of all schools and help, do custodial work.
Yeah. But before we get into that, I also want to kind of focus in on how the boxing gym is like almost like a safe space in a way for these kids to discuss traumatic events in their life. they mentioned the slashing that happened in the class probably a week ago. With the two girls, and they're all kind of like processing it, trying to like joke about it, or at least Naaman is like trying to like laugh his way out of the uncomfortableness. But then we also kind of get a glimpse into Randy's traumatic situation, because he says that one of the girls involved did go to a group home.
But yeah, Letitia, who
slashed the...
I think it's Shaquan. I don't know. My CC was messed up.
Oh, sorry. We get a look into... we just get like a glimpse into Randy's past life from that little comment. And we realize that, you know, getting cats boiled or like eating boiled cats is like something that's not even approaching the realm of possibility. Of like what goes on in those group homes, according to Randy's eyes, like his eyes tell that story.
Of course, you mentioned it kind of sheds light on a lot of these kids' characters, like Dookie in his crazy situation. Yeah. He's also like kind of maybe he's like dealing with, you know, like escapism or like fantasy. So his like imagination goes to try to escape his terrible home life. So he's like, oh man, it's like witchcraft and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wait, how come I've never really realized, like, oh, yeah, Randy's obviously been in group homes before, and this is a motivator in a lot of, you know his behavior at school, because he doesn't want to, you know, disappoint Miss Anna. But we'll talk about that in a
tragic
second.
Tragic shit.
Sorry I went out of turn there. I had the note. It's in my notes.
Kind of like a traumatic event for like everybody involved, like everybody's dealing with the ramifications of the slashing, and like they're talking about like, oh, you know, Shaquan didn't get HIV, just in case you're wondering. And Presbyluski is like, what? Like, yeah. I didn't even know that was a possibility. And I've been a police.
Yeah, I know. He's done a lot of training in his time. Yeah. You know, he did a lot of training, obviously. He's very aware of the community and their issues. But fuck Pres. Yeah, so, okay. All right, you want to talk about Cuddy still?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You kind of.
Yeah, sorry.
It's like, we can't, like, just, we got to let loose, man.
Yeah. But
undo.
As you alluded to earlier, Cuddy's being hired in a custodial position, but he's not using a broom. He's using more of a metaphorical vacuum cleaner, as, you know, Principal Donnelly would refer to it as. And she's basically saying, like, you're a truant officer, but we're not going to call you a truant officer.
AP Donnelly.
Oh, is this? Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter, really. But so a few things about this. I think first, most importantly, like, obviously, like, the component that's most integral to this episode, Rudy Williams. he was talking about, yeah, you know, I got a sent to Boys Village for truancy.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what set him off. He said, like, you know, if they would have dealt with it differently, I maybe wouldn't have gone to this, like, crime college, you know, because you have to lie about why you're there, because you have this, you know, survival. So he, you know, kind of, he's, I,
like,
mean,
I robbed people. Like, that's what, that was his lie to, like, make himself fit in, seem like he could fit in with everybody else.
So, I mean, maybe it's not the worst thing that, well, I don't know. It's like, it's a slippery slope, but
yeah.
Cuddy's like, wait, there's no truancy officers? Because he's been away for so long too. And Miss Donnelly's like, what? Like, do you think this is Montgomery County? And I was wondering if you remember, because I obviously didn't do the reading that I was supposed to refresh, you know, on for season 4, but was Tootsie Duvall really working in schools, like maybe in Montgomery County, like in doing attendance work and stuff like that?
Maybe
after, or, like, you know, maybe was it before people saw her on the show? Like, you just, aren't you a real, you know?
I don't know, because she was also in the corner too. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Mean, like in between or after. So it's like, she's like making a joke about somewhere else where she worked, where there's a lot more resources. So
right.
Cuddy is now filling that void. Also, it's like, she's like, you're a good man, you know? And then, you know, it's like, is everyone forgetting that he killed Vincent's cousin, Elijah Davis? Okay. Simulation. I'm losing it.
I don't know.
But also, more importantly, you know, he knows now that this is where Grace works. So, like, are they going to run into each other, like, off camera? And that's going to be major drama. Or he's just like, no, I'm just driving my van around now.
I remember they do rendezvous with each other at one point during the season.
A great memory, man. I can't remember anything sometimes.
That's all right. Like, that's why we're doing this.
Stuck in refugee status. All right, but I mean, like, his job, or you got some intel?
No, go ahead.
His job's pretty crazy, though. I mean, it's all in the game, I guess. It's like, you know, he's going out trying to get these kids in, you know, Dennis style, like, school is school. You know, a man is a man, a woman's a woman. I'm real old-fashioned. You're going to go to school. And then his associate's telling him that, you know, it's really just
a numbers game.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And kid has to show up to, like, school one day a month, basically.
Yeah, you got
to
put kids in seats and get your funding. Yeah. And the kids know, you know, the game better than he does at that point. And then, sticking on the theme of education, I kind of already buried this, but, you know, he's an old-fashioned guy, Cuddy, so he believes that people, especially young kids and young men, should go to school regardless of this, like, numbers game. And then his associate tells him, I'm just trying to school you.
Yeah, he's going to the new school right now. He's graduated from old school when he left Jessup.
And I love how shocked and disturbed Cuddy looks, or Dennis looks, as the kid's like, no, I already did my day. I'm fat till October. picks up another 40 or whatever empty bottle and just like chucks it at the wall. He's like, it's like there's kids just like openly talking about people's like a young girl's face getting slashed. He's like, all right, man, follow through with that jab. Like 1-2. He's like, oh my God,
somebody just smashed a bottle.
This is insanity.
But what do you make? So
his eyes, Coleman's eyes.
We definitely knew people when we were going to like middle and high school who took advantage of the whole, like, I only need to show up for a certain amount of days. It's all like a game of the funding and everything. Like, did you see like some of our friends in that like conversation? Like, you know, we're always trying to relate things back to our own personal experience. Totally. So like, do you think like Robo was ever like, school is school, man?
Yeah. He's like, school is school.
Let me get a cigarette.
Yeah. Yeah. What is that you're concealing there? You know, move your jacket to block the wind while I, yeah. To your point about the funding, I do understand, because I thought this was something people just knew about, right? Like, not even related to The Wire, but without being too personal, I overheard people once talking about like how hard the school closures were for certain school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's all about attendance, and people are like, wow, you know, tell me more. I'm like, wait, what? Like, people didn't know this when they were in high school and stuff. Like, yeah, we're talking about adults. So that was pretty interesting to learn that this is not just a known thing.
Yeah,
you know, everything good.
Pretty illuminating, right? When you're exposed to people's naivety.
I'm going to my doctor now. Apparently, I know too much.
Back to my maps, where I'm looking at the grocery store on Monroe.
Yeah, Monroe,
quote unquote.
Hey Willie, pick me up at that grocery store.
We see Dennis doing his thing in the middle school and like becoming kind of disillusioned with the whole process. But we also kind of like get some insight. This is like subtly building throughout the season, and I definitely didn't catch it around the first time. But Dennis is like almost trying to like aspire to being kind of like a father figure to a lot of these kids. So he's like expressing, you know, kind of like affection to these boys. Yeah. And at one point he like leans on Michael, but Michael like fucking darts across the room, basically. Or he's just like, maneuvers out of it,
sprinting away. He like ran across the room.
No, he didn't run, but he like maneuvers out of that.
He slips the hand on his shoulder, like Dennis would have taught him to, you know, avoid a jab.
And it's just like you know, providing us some insight as well into Michael's background, where he possibly was sexually assaulted by his father. And just like, you know, the way he slips out of Dennis's friendly little shoulder lean, and the way he like gets out of the van, similar to like Randy's haunted eyes when talking about the group home, just like dropping little sprinklets along the way that gives us insight into their backstory.
Yeah. So like, I mean, the whole like van thing in the middle of the night, like, okay, if we didn't see these other small signs, I'd be like, okay, yeah, he's like a young kid, and you know, I've gotten a ride home from like coaches at night, and you don't know them really. I mean, you know them as like your coach, and they yell at you sometimes, and sometimes they're nicer, but then you're like, you know, I'm an awkward like 14-year-old or 13-year-old, like, I don't, or whatever, teenager, I don't have much to say. Like, if I could just like get out with like my teammate and be like, peace out and walk home, maybe. But this is a whole different situation, because it's also West Baltimore late at night, and Cuddy's trying to keep them off the streets. So it's like, you're defeating my whole purpose. I'm trying to just drop you at your like house. Don't like, walk off into the middle of the night alone.
Yeah, it was like, when I first watched this episode, I was like, is he like ashamed to let Dennis know where he lives? Like, he doesn't want to see him living in semi-squalor or something. But
I guess, I don't know, like the row houses are all like kind of similar in some ways. It's more like the inside, because like, look at his row house and then look at Lex's mom's row house. It's like, we'll talk about that later, but looks, you know, like from the outside it could be deceiving. I don't know.
Right,
anyways, I get your point though. I'd probably been there. Like,
I did want to, I'm sorry to circle back on this, but you did have a little interesting note about like one of the t-shirts that the kids are wearing when they're trying to go on their truancy mission.
This is perfect because we'll just, jump right into like school or but yeah, it's one of those, and you know, we're always relating things back to our youth, you know,
right?
Boys of summer, in no way like is, you know, anything we experience, you know, to this magnitude, but of course like urban culture was very pervasive where we grew up, even if it's like some weird semi urban suburban like hybrid. But you know, this whole like stop snitching
trash out there.
Well, he's like, goddamn trailer trash. Well, I mean, you know, it was diverse too. Definitely like white trash kids were like the worst, you know, in a lot of ways. But what I'm getting at is like the whole, you know, stop sign, stop snitching, or like the no snitching anytime, like a parking sign. You know, as the kid who owes his day to the institution, you know, he needs to stop lobbing bottles at the wall and let Herbert Brown enjoy his fun and get himself in the van. But yeah, that, you know, it's like, that's the culture obviously. Right. So stop snitching or no snitching anytime. I know I get a lot of heat sometimes from people about being a snitch allegedly. So, you know, I empathize with Randy a lot.
Oh, no, you're a good guy. But it's this is like an example of like the set design or the costume design further like reinforcing the themes that are prevalent in these people's lives and therefore in the show.
Do you think it was a deliberate choice though? Because I know like this season really is one that, you know, like I can draw parallels to the most as far as like the music or the style of dress, because, you know, I was like early, like mid-teens, like early high school, like a lot of the songs obviously, but that was such a popular shirt back then. Just like, is one of the actors kids just like that's what he showed up in, or Simon Burns like, no, we gotta get you one of those stop snitching shirts, just like, you know, kids wear those white tees or whatever.
Well, fuck, man, at first I thought it was like a David Simon Ed Burns collab, but like that, I mean, that kind of goes in line with their thinking of sometimes how, you know, they would just like let serendipitous things happen like that.
It probably is. But yeah, I mean, to the whole snitching thing, I mean, Randy, can we jump right to there? Because kind of like an intersection of Cuddy and, you know, the kids that he sees outside of school.
He sees. No.
He has them in his gym. Dennis obviously knows what's going on, or maybe he doesn't. You know, it's not a huge gym. Anyways, Randy's been pulled into the office by Miss Donnelly, or another teacher caught him, you know, hustling with his other t-shirt, which another parallel, of course. I don't know. I know you're a couple grades older, but we had we had some kids that would sell like snacks.
Yeah. And,
you know, there's shouts out to Juice Man. He would get in trouble. I'd always be like, why are they tripping on you selling Capri Suns? But then I found out maybe that wasn't all he was selling. But anyways, he was a businessman, but it's like apparently a big no-no.
Yeah.
And then Donnelly's basically like doing the whole interrogation thing, like being a cop basically.
Yeah.
Like, these are your options, you know, like pressuring him like a homicide detective or someone would do to like a perp.
Is Dennis like indicating to him in this scene? Like he's he's another one, like his facial movements are like so like subtle and small sometimes. Chad Coleman. Like George Pelicano said, like, there's like so much going on behind your eyes. Yeah. Like, so is Dennis like subtly like giving Randy advice in this moment to not snitch?
He's like, or like, better, you know, we better get Randy one of those shirts that the kids I round up are wearing. Probably. I mean, he knows the consequences. Obviously he's been in the streets.
This is,
I don't know though. I didn't pick it up. I think he was more just like intrigued, like, right, oh, just, like, what, where's this kid at? You know, where's his spine? Like, he's in a terrible decision, or he's in a terrible position, and either way, his decision's like, you can't win, you know?
Yeah.
So I want to see what Randy's up to, because Randy's not really a boxer. He mostly talks with Naaman and Michael, and
like, right.
Randy just kind of hangs out, has other things going on. But yeah, pretty terrible situation.
Yeah, so this is just him like being aware of the surroundings.
Yeah, so I don't know what else did I jump too far ahead, but Bubbles you want to talk about?
Or? Sure, yeah. But he's trying to educate Sherrod, school Sherrod, on the importance of like going to school. You know, it's like coming to work for me, like you don't want to miss a day.
You got some interesting stuff to say here about Bubbles, who you're always you know, fighting for his rights and, you know, equal pay, and you say, do as I say, not as I do.
Right, because he's still on the it's when I thought of you, because on the commentary they're like, you know, discussing like the dichotomy of like, you know, what Bubbles is like preaching, but also what he's practicing. And they're like, it's so tragic because he's trying to get Sherrod to go to school, but he's still on the dope.
The dope? Yeah. He's still for the streets.
Yeah, but this is one of the many things that's like kind of like contributing to Bubbles' eventual wake-up call, that like he sees him, you know, not being able to read. He sees him like with the French dictionary and the math book, like knowing obviously like that's not part of the curriculum. Sherrod is like not in the grade he's supposed to be, but it's like the whole concept of social promotion is just ensuring his like early failure in all this.
I mean, I wonder, you know, and I posited some you know, questions or made little notes, like, what, you know, what is the whole relationship between he and Bubbles? You know, he's going through all this to make up some elaborate tale on, you know, what he's studying, and like, right, oh yeah, this is my workbook, you know. It's like trying to go show up and make Bubbles proud, but it's like, how did they even meet? Are they actually family? Or we still don't, like, we don't know what happened, because one minute Sherrod's like on the corner, and the next minute Bubbles has another intern, then he's got Sherrod. It's like,
is this like Bubbles like trying to atone for his lifestyle, or he's like, I can be a father figure to somebody, and Sherrod is like, you're not a complete like psychopath, like killer, like
you're not my dad.
Kind of have your shit together, like barely holding on. Seems like a good fit. Odd couple.
Yeah, you know, Bubbles feels bad. He knows about Johnny, right? Because Johnny's not been around.
Yeah,
he knows where he was headed. You know, I could have got Johnny before, when he was, you know, before he started doing drugs. But then again, probably wouldn't have happened, because Johnny's probably from like the county or somewhere else.
Guilt complex major.
Yeah. So,
did you want to say anything about the story that Bubbles relates about?
For my map.
It's in the map.
Yeah, it's in the map. Well, yeah, just like, shed some light for me, because I've always kind of wondered, you know, what Bubbles' story is, and I'm sure you dropped other little hints as to where he's from or where he grew up, but my whole thing was always, oh yeah, he kind of sounds like he's from New York, or Andre Royal's from. It's like, maybe like Bubbles, you know,
right?
Or maybe he picked up the accent when he was really doing what real Bubbles used to do and go up to New York and get fugitives and all that stuff. But he says the playground on Baker and Moreland, which is up in like not Northwest Baltimore, but yeah, I mean, it's like a little higher up in Baltimore than where probably a lot of the stuff's supposed to be based. So, and there is a little park there. So, they're on their geo with this one.
Yeah,
But yeah, then it's like pretty, really, it's really sad as he goes to go tie off, to right. shoot up while Sherrod's studying. Right. He's like, oh yeah, then the touts, you know, start calling out the Heron, and then, you know, everything just goes downhill.
Right. He was like talking about like the shift of like always hearing the ice cream truck, and then it turned into like kids trucks. Shouting about, you know,
yeah. or the new
package. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a little bit about like Prez's specific dilemma and like trying to reach these kids, because he seems pretty like disillusioned and like zombified by the whole thing. He's like sitting at a football game, just absentmindedly, like he's like taking notes, but then like doodling around them, like making like weird circles and underlines and like just like weird drawings. Like he's trying to come up with a plan, but he's pretty incompetent at this point as a teacher and just like as a leader and father figure.
Is he a father?
No, not a father. Like,
I thought you were saying like
no, he's not a father. But like, I'm like,
not all teachers are
in the paternalistic sense of like a teacher, or like, you know, parental sense of like when teachers kind of, I don't know.
Well, I don't know, man. You know more about it, like education and. I mean, you had a parent who was your parent and a teacher. Is that what you?
I don't know what I'm talking about. But quick little, give us
the insight on that.
Quick little
reference.
Yeah, quick little bit of trivia, just for all you hardcore fans out there. With Prez absentmindedly keeping the football game on and just remarking like, oh, nobody wins, just one side loses more slowly. That's almost a word for word quote from the 1975 movie Night Moves, directed by Arthur Penn and starring Gene Hackman, you know, same director as Bonnie and Clyde. Just a little side note, terrific movie. I saw it at the New Beverly Theater several years ago. Check it out if you haven't. It's a great crime drama.
How many stars?
4 stars.
Oh, right.
4 out of 4.
Woo! Yeah. All right, man. Yeah. I'll have to one day check it out, I guess.
Great movie. But you were talking a little bit about like how you felt like kind of confused that like this incident of violence is so much more impactful on Prez's psyche than like,
yeah.
you know, him blind. You know, we shouldn't at any point forget
yeah.
that he partially blinded a kid of the same age of the, yeah. like, you know, what's in his class right now. So like, you know, maybe spare me your sympathy or your tears for like what you did in the past is like contributing to part of the problem. So maybe don't fucking come complaining to me that you feel like you can't reach these kids on a level. Why don't you try blinding one? Well, maybe that'll work out better for you. Fucking no, he's trying to become a good guy.
Okay. Sounds like a good thing you're doing there, bud. Does it just show that the police inherently have like less humanity, and as soon as he's stripped of his badge and gun, he's like, oh, like this is how real people internalize violence that occurs around them. Yeah. Whereas like, oh, I got my badge and I'm just out here, you know, ripping and running, busting heads, you know, it's all part of the job. But I mean, he's an extreme example. And
right.
I guess, I don't know. But yeah, this is like really affecting him, and his wife is there having to deal with one traumatic thing after another.
Right.
You know, of course she has to deal even with probably the ultimate tragedy or traumatic event, which is being Valchek's daughter. But yeah, I mean, let's not, like you said, forget all the really bad things Prez was involved in, and he's actually even killed someone. So I don't know if this is triggering PTSD, because up till this point, I mean, it's never touched on, except for the fact that he lost his job.
Right.
You know? The actual events aren't, you know, highlighted too much, or you know, he needs counseling or something.
And yeah. And it's like, as soon as it's brought up in the classroom, like, oh, I used to be a police. Yeah. Everybody's like, oh, you kill somebody? Like, you shoot people?
Yeah.
And, like, and he's like, that's not at all. Like, that's not all what the job is about.
Yeah. Like, just remember the reports I pulled. And, oh, yeah, exactly what Naaman's enacting. I did to Wagoner, basically. It's hard to watch sometimes. Prez's face. No, but yeah, I mean, the kids are, you know, keen, you know, they talk about how, you know, when Prez is trying to say that's not what it's about. It's about, like, what he's trying to say, it's about, like, reaching and serving the community. And they're saying, you know, the only time you come to the community is to wail on people.
Yeah.
So they all.
They see him for what he is, basically.
Is, like, is that why you're maybe, sorry to cut you off, but you know how the kids terrify you? Because they will see you
for what you are. Yeah, that's part of it. I'm afraid they're just going to, like, put my soul on display for everybody to laugh at and mock.
It is, you know, it is humbling. But, you know, you haven't killed, like, colleague ostensibly.
Right.
Or
shot up my own car.
Yeah.
Shot a hole in a brick wall.
You ever shot your office or blinded kids or, you know, you're a good guy. You'll be great. So when are we going to go enroll in the credential program? You know, they need more teachers than ever. Everyone's quitting, right?
Right.
After this year of online work, like, this is terrible.
I mean, maybe I'll try to get involved in the experimental program that Parenti, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's his piloting name. Of reaching corner kids as opposed to stoop kids.
Yeah, man. So let's talk about, Bunny at the school. Miss Conway, who's down at the, what is she, at North Avenue or wherever they keep talking about the headquarters are. She's like the arm of the superintendent, or is she the superintendent?
Ooh.
I don't think so, but she's high up.
Yeah.
And is like, just stay out of everyone's way. This is an election.
Yeah.
Crazy. Great advice to create change.
Yeah. Crazy how everybody is, like, so insistent on not rocking the boat this season because of the looming election.
Yeah.
And how that has consequences for everybody. But
it's all one big deflection.
This is just like another law enforcement figure getting embedded in the school system and kind of being shocked at what he sees on a day-to-day basis and just walking through the hallways.
Yeah.
But it's like he does get a nice glimpse into, like, one of the teachers basically just, like, roasting everybody. Like, not roasting implies, like, a lighthearted, like, fun side to, like,
this is what Willie just, okay, that's how Willie roasts, right? Like, prejudice.
Yeah. But he, you know, he witnesses a teacher, like, basically, demeaning his classroom full of students, you know, insulting them for their low test scores and, you know, their impoverished backgrounds and, like, what the teacher perceives them to grow up as.
Yeah.
Pretty, like, demoralizing, horrible moment, contrasted with, like, a teacher who's, like, actually effectively reaching out to her students and getting people to talk about how Clarence Mitchell Jr. was important for the civil rights movement. So,
yeah. Before we talk a little on that, maybe when Prez shows up, you know, after this season, the only season after this, season 5, and he's like, hey, like, no, you, like, back off. I'm in control. And, you know, he looks like he has it all together. He's got the beard going and all that stuff. You know, everyone's like, oh, wow, look, he figured it out. I'm not too sure that, you know, that guy who's, you know, given the 20 doesn't mean, you know, the amount of time you're going to spend in jail. No, it means, like, this and that, and you failed. Yeah, you know, I want to think that that's actually what Prez's ultimate form was at Tillman.
Oh, no. Come on.
Like, not the person who's, like, teaching. No, I mean, he does do the whole, like, you know,
let's
trick them into thinking they're not learning.
Yeah, so let's play dice. Let's gamble.
He's more hands-on.
Right.
But a part of me wants to believe, like, that's... Because for a second I was like, wait, Prez doesn't have it together. Oh, wait, that's not him. That's just the other white guy teacher at the school. Yeah, so... you know, the other teacher, she's got it going on. Like, so this is your "Are you smarter than a sixth grader" moment, because the kids know who Clarence Mitchell Jr. was and his significance to the civil rights movement. They're like, pick on me. So everyone, you know, Willie's raising his hand. He's like, "Ooh, I do. I know. I'm like, no, okay, let's. Okay, it's just us here. No guess. Willie, what do you think?"
He's a longtime lobbyist for the NAACP.
Yeah. Yay. Amazing.
That's, I mean, there's more. I briefly skimmed the Wikipedia article about it.
Pretty much all the major civil rights legislation passed up until, I think, like, as late as the 80s, or it was a very vast, like, decades of, you know, impact he had. And then basically, you know, since we were talking a little about, like, the walking around money and the machine and all that stuff, his, not like they were involved in politics, the Mitchells, but more so like his brother was named Perrin Mitchell. And he was probably the most well-known Mitchell because he was the first black representative from Maryland. And really prominent, you know, on that side of things, whereas like his brother was more NAACP and all that. But yeah, so his mother-in-law was Lily Mae Jackson, who pretty much was like one of the main catalysts for starting Baltimore's NAACP chapter, which at its peak was the second largest in the country behind New York City, or like, yeah, wow. New York. So it was huge, like, in its influence. And of course they had like the most influential person, but yeah, she was super involved. And then her daughter was named Juanita Jackson, and she married Clarence Mitchell Jr. So they were like a power for, like, civil rights, you know, like NAACP political powerhouse. So, pretty crazy family. Yeah. Did a lot of, you know, accomplished a lot, but of course, like, influence brings, you know, I don't know. I don't think Rudy was doing any campaigning for them, but you never know. Yeah. You never know who they're involved with. But yeah, no. Nah. Sounds like a good thing he did there. All right, man.
All right, so we could pretty much move on to the police aspect of this storyline, right? That's the final thing we have to talk about.
I was looking at it like, oh, man, okay, where are we? Yeah, this is crazy. Yeah, so Landsman, you know, with his zingers, like, oh, Mary Mo Heaves talent.
Yeah.
We know who's writing this episode, right?
Yeah.
Pretty ingenious stuff, you know, by Simon to throw shots back at his old editor, right?
Yeah. I mean, but this is in the credits. It says Dennis Lehane and Ed Burns were, I mean.
He's Dennis. Fuck Mary Mo.
Yeah.
All right. Man. No, will he pull credit on me?
No.
Chain of credit, Jakob.
But I mean, you know, as we know, like, what goes into TV writing, David Simon probably like rewrote like 90% of this episode and kept like a little exchange and was like, yeah, Dennis, this is great. Yeah. We'll put your name in the credit. No.
Let's remember, Mary Mo sucks.
Yeah.
Mary Mao? Mary Diddy Mao.
But anyway, let's talk about Kima getting her introduction to the homicide unit. It's kind of like a reintroduction for us as the audience. We kind of get like reacquainted with like a lot of the idiosyncrasies. We see the cut necktie mausoleum, how Jay Landsman reverently you know, does the whole cross thing around the coffee machine, and you know, Kima's in for a bit of hazing. She's victim to a fart joke and, you know, some zoo puns.
Yeah. All right, it's crazy, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, man.
So a lot of this is taken from Homicide, right? Like these anecdotes.
Yeah. I can't remember. Do you remember like the specific stories? Or
I feel like the Tater thing.
Oh yeah, Tater was like the, you know, we're gonna talk about the big lie. So we'll leave it at that, right? With the whole Xerox and all that.
Right.
I think that. I mean, but Tater comes up a lot.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know. What do you think about the whole hazing? Because then they make jokes or like Mr. Sweet and like gay lesbian stuff. So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like a locker room talk they'll just say or whatnot. She's the only female detective that we're privy to, right?
Right.
Pretty
much.
There was one brought up in Homicide that I remember, right? Like Bertina Silver or something. What's her name? So it's not a common thing. That's what I'm getting at. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's police. Anyways, but she's getting screwed because, well, at the time, it seems like it, because she's getting the Braddock case as the top brass don't want anything to do with the witness angle, and they're just pushing it off on the rookie detective to try to like elude an actual finding.
Right. It's another election year strategy.
Yeah.
They don't want it to come back on Royce that he's still not getting the whole witness angle, right?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
Nobody wants to rock the boat.
If only Braddock was Nick Sabatka, he'd be out at the, you know, the Anon, the Anon Pulaski Highway.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately for him, well, we'll learn. It's like a whole, it's like there's always a twist, right? So, Braddock's case isn't always what it seems, right?
Right.
Okay, so what else, man? Like, the boys are getting back together.
Yeah.
Bunk and Mrs. McNulty, and they want to go to you know, get together out in the field, also have some drinks. First, they got to go by Lex's mom's spot again.
Yeah.
To see if he's home.
And they already have like a little shrine set up to Lex. So it's like
shit.
The mom knows that he's dead basically, but doesn't want to, like part of her is still in denial about it. She's like going through like traumatic shock. Her eyes is always looking like she's just seen a ghost. Some sort of scary apparition.
Talk about ghosts. Do you think she could possibly be one? Because I don't know if 643 Harlem Avenue, which I'm assuming the address is, exists. I can't find a 600 block. So again, this is like a void and like
one simulation thing. Void.
Yeah.
Simulated void.
Like, I don't know. Do addresses change? Like, is it like a redistricting, you know, city council map? I don't know if you could just say, all right, we're not going to have a 600 block of Harlem anymore. Well, you never know. Maybe the street that it turns into at that juncture, like they change that name. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's neither here nor there. I just, you know, I got to like, I can't like help myself.
No, I get it. But, so yeah, they try to go through Lex's house and see if they can find anything about this homicide that Bunk is working. They're disappointed, and Bunk and Lester, not, you know, McNulty's not around for this because he's domesticated. They go knock back a few. But the whole like point of this scene is that Bunk is horny and Lester is only horny for the truth.
Besides.
Yeah. Yeah. Bunk is making eyes at some ladies across the way, and Lester is trying to like think out loud and like work through, you know, how to pin Marlo down. Like, basically, the major crimes unit is shut down, so he doesn't have as many resources. And Lester at some point talks about Eddie Crane and Curtis Bay, and you sent me a really fascinating article about that unsolved mystery. So, yeah. I don't know if you want to just briefly give a little background to the context of that comment.
Yeah, so he Lester makes a comment, like you said, theorizing about where Marlo could be dumping bodies, and he also is like on Fat Face Rick levels. He's like, "What if he has a rogue funeral parlor or something?" Yeah. You know? Then he's like, "What if he got dissolved in acid like Eddie Crane?" And then that little clipping I sent you, which is from a longer article by David Simon. Oh, here's like a, you know, different article from Yahoo, like that's a little more, I don't know, that's actually probably darker, because it's like, if anyone could write a darker story about a death, it's someone like a relative of actual
the daughter person.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, David Simon does his best, but his was basically from 1992, And that was 5 years after Eddie Crane disappeared.
Right.
And Curtis Bay from his, like, basically it was like E&M machinery, or basically they would salvage or cannibalize old trucks and or trucks and sell the parts. And then right. they thought it was a dispute between he and a business partner who I think his name was Augie. I forgot his last name. But
right. Basically, yeah. Eddie Crane accused Augie of embezzling funds, and yeah, some people suspect Augie killed him over an argument that they had. But
yeah, thanks for filling that out.
Sorry.
No, I know. I'm like, I'm losing it. But yeah, it's just like never found him. So yeah. Daughter thought that he was like in a wall or something, buried there. And, you know, it's Curtis Bay. It's a real like kind of eerie seeming place. It's basically, I mean, not only do they have to deal with the rat white Mike, but they also basically for a long time just got like, you know, every like all the bad things that the city didn't want to deal with throughout history just kind of like got, you know, pushed down the Patapsco or whatnot down there. So kind of like an industrial wasteland, and then of course urban decay and all that. So, but you know, the streets talk, but no one really ever explained what happened to her dad. And
yeah, so,
you know, everything in the show, it's like, and it's also a homicide,
right?
Based on like it, you know, inspired a episode of Homicide. So yeah. Are we gonna have to watch that? We're gonna have to watch that.
I have to, yeah. I've watched everything else that David Simon is connected to at this point. So I'm gonna have to spring for like the 19 DVD box set of the Homicide complete series with the Law and Order crossover episodes, with the documentary and with the feature film attached to the television series.
Oh man, I gotta watch it.
Nah.
I might as well, because like my guilt, like I am guilty of watching that first 48 show once in a while for no reason, which is like, you know, problematic at best.
Propaganda.
Oh yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
And they like just forget about that, you know, like a 10-year-old girl was killed once in an episode a long time ago during one of their stupid raids that they never actually got someone.
Fuck.
All right, man. So that's a great way to end this episode.
And then also we have Kirk and Dozerman getting, sullied off onto the Major Crimes Unit under Mary Mal, and it's like almost like a match made in heaven for Herc. I mean, they do kind of, Herc and Dozerman do a kind of hint at Mary Mal being a prick, but they have no problem with doing the rip and runs the Western District way that this guy wants them to do. Like, this is like the target demographic that Mary Mal is like aiming for in this moment.
Dozer Herc.
Herker man.
That's a terrifying Dozer man. Still like, I can't really say much.
Yeah, but this is gonna have implications down the line. In the broader Wire universe, Herc being utilized in this kind of like meat-headed, non-thinking fashion.
Crazy.
Fuck Mary Mal. Fuck the Baltimore Sun. Nah. I know you have a subscription and you bring up a lot of like interesting archival articles, but the power structure
have a subscription.
Yeah, there we go. All right. Do you think that's a good way to appease the gods, since they're not going to save us? You know, we brought you this hour and 38 minute
hour episode. And 38, that's all.
Yeah.
Nice.
We can trim, probably trim something like 20 minutes off. Anyway.
Yeah, man.
Thank you so much to everybody who's listened to this all the way through. We really appreciate your support. If you want to reach out more, we're on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Gods Will Not Save You.
Yeah, and if you prefer just to go through, an email, correspondence route with us, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. Drop us, any feedback, comments, questions, concerns. We'd love to hear from you. Just mostly about The Wire, though.
Right, yeah. Please don't talk to us about CSI or Law and Order or Shield or any of these
Breaking
other...
Breaking Bad, how it's better.
But anyway, also thanks to Mostart, credible musician who did the intro and outro theme and the bumper music. Yeah, Jakob's going to give me a sticker to take home with me, but I will not be putting it on my windshield or on my car.
Yeah.
But check him out at mostart.com. You could probably see the sticker design on his website.
Yeah, definitely. And big thanks to Andre Tesnes, who designed our very detailed and amazing emblem. So big shout out.
Right on.
Big ups.
Right on. Thanks, everybody.
See you next. Talk to you next time.